This is a $80 phone from Taiwan that'll run Vonage service. It'll be priced at $19.95. So that gives you a sense of the power of Wi-Fi, of mesh technology, of WiMAX, and of voice over IP telephony. And that's why we're hearing so much about Wi-Fi mesh, why we're hearing so much about Philadelphia, why we're hearing so much on the legislative front, arguments about for and against municipalities getting in the business of telecommunications using Wi-Fi mesh. So that's our technology on a show-and-tell basis. I want to just talk about it a little bit more using a few slides here. I think it'll be useful as a way to frame this next panel. So just a little bit more specifics. These are deployed on street lamps, about 20 per square mile. They're installed with this very sophisticated screwdriver. That's it. It takes about 6 minutes to install one of these devices. It's a mesh, which means the devices communicate to each other wirelessly. They configure each other and themselves. And so basically you hang these things on streetlights. They're up and running. You have a broadband network. So we deploy, let's say, 20 per square mile in Philadelphia. We beam in WiMAX. You guys, yeah. So we beam in a point-to-multipoint radio signal into the mesh using WiMAX technology from a tall building. Into one or two of these devices per square mile, and now you have a broadband wireless network for about $70,000 per square mile, or approximately $10 million for the city of Philadelphia. Not taking up any streets, you can deploy in Philadelphia in somewhere between 3 and 6 months all in, including the design and configuration, and you've got metro scale Wi-Fi mesh. We are, you're probably familiar with Clay Christensen. I think about metro scale Wi-Fi mesh and Tropos as being a classic low-end disruption. In particular, you know, we hear a lot about fiber to the home and, you know, faster and faster speeds on the wired side to get video, 100 channels of video, et cetera. The cellular guys are all doing TV on their devices and radio, et cetera. Our technology is focused on delivering $15 native IP connectivity, both as a wireline alternative and as an alternative to mobile cellular data. So it's a classic low-end disruption in Clay Christensen terms. And by the way, I mentioned Vonage on these phones. You'll sometime, I think before the end of Q1 next year, you'll see Skype on these devices as well. So now you've got a $90 phone where you can make free calling phone to phone, and maybe it's going to be 2 cents a minute to call any other phone in the world. So think about the potential for that disrupting the traditional cellular business the same way Wi-Fi mesh is being thought of as disrupting the wired DSL and cable business. You know, Wi-Fi as a phenomenon just keeps marching on. We hear a lot about WiMAX these days, and it certainly is an interesting technology, but I want to just put it in perspective. Today there's 140 million Wi-Fi devices, PDAs, laptops, et cetera. IDC expects that to grow to 250 million by the end of 2008. And you see the progression continues to be linear in terms of growth of these devices. There's you know, as much as we deride hotspots and, you know, the hotspot model is a non-starter, et cetera, there's 120,000 hotspots in the world today. And, again, IDC predicts that there'll be almost 200,000 hotspots by 2008. And perhaps most interestingly, INSTAT predicts that there will be some 66 million dual-mode cellular Wi-Fi phones by the end of next year, and there may be as many as 200 million by 2008. So many of us are going to be walking around with Wi-Fi in our pockets to be used anywhere in conjunction with cellular, with Wi-Fi mesh networking. So the numbers are really working in our favor, and that's really the primary demand for and the primary driver for all the interest that we're seeing in metro-scale Wi-Fi mesh. So this is a map of Tropos deployments. We've got 250 cities deployed with metro-scale Wi-Fi mesh today, and that's a square mile or more of coverage. Our largest network is 400 contiguous square miles of Wi-Fi in Oklahoma City. That's a public safety network, so the police are using that to access crime databases, et cetera. In fact, Tropos started to sell into public safety after 9/11, an inexpensive, quick way to get broadband into police cars. After that, our early adopting cities looked up and said, oh, it's just Wi-Fi. Can we open it up for other applications? Sure you can. So cities started to provide Wi-Fi to their citizens at $16 a month. That got whisked into the business. We now are a supplier to Earthlink, among other ISPs who are bidding on many cities, including Philadelphia, Minneapolis, Portland, and San Francisco, because they need another way to get into a home. Now we're starting to see significant interest among cable operators who need a wireless play. In fact, we announced a few weeks ago a distribution deal with Scientific Atlanta, and you can expect us to make announcements about primary customers in the cable space. So they intend to overbuild themselves with Wi-Fi as a cheap way to deliver wireless to their customers in their footprint. So 250 customers today. We believe there's another 200 cities that are in the process of procuring metro-scale Wi-Fi solutions. Here's a list of some of them. I'm sorry, it's small type, but big cities, Minneapolis, Milwaukee, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, San Diego, Portland, et cetera. So this is a phenomenon that just continues to march on. Again, all driven by the need for low-cost broadband and the fact that Wi-Fi is becoming ubiquitous. It's an international phenomenon. Wi-Fi is really the first truly global radio standard. You can open your Wi-Fi-enabled laptop pretty much anywhere in the world and use it. And that's not true even of cellular infrastructure. So we get tremendous economies of scale. This same technology works just as well in Kinshasa as it does in downtown Philadelphia. Just to give you a sense of the economics, this is the result of lots and lots of ROI models we've done with carriers around the world over the last couple of years. And, you know, I want to focus you on the CapEx per home pass and the average cost per user. Less than $30 a home pass to install and operate a metro-scale Wi-Fi network. That compares with more than $50 a home pass for EBDO, all the way up to $70 for cable, and I don't even bother putting fiber on the chart here. And operating expense is equally as impressive, less than $7 per subscriber to operate one of these networks, including the marketing costs and everything else. And compare that to two or three times as much for traditional technologies. So again, classic low-end disruption, that's what's driving our technology in the market. So technically, all we've done is invented metro-scale Wi-Fi mesh routing protocols, which allow this radio to communicate with that radio over there wirelessly. This radio can communicate typically with 10 other radios in the environment. The routing protocols route around interference. If there's a failure in the network, we route around that as well. So effectively, what we've done is applied routing protocols to extend the footprint of Wi-Fi from the home and the enterprise into the great outdoors. And so in that sense, we're getting all the benefit of a consumer electronics cost curve, hundreds of millions of these devices sitting in your home, and we're applying it successfully to a carrier class problem. And WiMAX will extend that another level once it becomes ubiquitous in its mobile incarnation. From a technology perspective, we are a software company. Inside this box is an Atheros chip for the radio. We use AMD processors. It's all off-the-shelf technology. So our intellectual property is all wrapped up in our mesh routing software, which does all the communication and provides network management to our service providers. We have outdoor units, we have indoor units, and we have mobile units. So we're actually deploying Wi-Fi with mobility on trains, planes, and automobiles in our coverage area as well, which is great for first responders, and it's also great for consumer access. So So I'm not going to read all of these. We've got anything that has a Wi-Fi device, that has a Wi-Fi antenna on it. We are networking today. We're providing $16 broadband access to Chaska, Minnesota. We were doing video surveillance in the high crime areas of New Orleans for the police using high-end pan-tilt zoom cameras to great benefit for the police down there. Our public safety network in Oklahoma City, I mentioned, we're doing a free Wi-Fi network in St. Cloud, Florida, to attract businesses into downtown St. Cloud. And the thing that we're most proud of that we've done very recently here, next slide, please, is we actually provided the first and only communication to Red Cross, FEMA, and other disaster relief centers in conjunction with many of our WISCs in the Gulf and also with MCI and courtesy of Intel. When there was no other way to get communication into those centers, we were able to install these Wi-Fi devices, run them on generators, connect them to MCI points of presence using WiMAX. We were literally up and running with voice, video, and data within 24 hours of when the hurricane hit. We've now got 27 FEMA and Red Cross relief centers online, including the hospital ships that are out on the Gulf. So Wi-Fi, unlicensed technology, mesh, WiMAX are providing great service in terms of disaster recovery, and we're spending a lot of time in Washington these days trying to convince the government that they really ought to think about this very self-healing and resilient technology as an alternative to rebuilding exactly what was there before. So we're very proud of this, and we're still spending a lot of time and energy on that. So that's a little bit of an introduction to mesh, to metro-scale Wi-Fi. There's a lot of excitement about it. I can see the signs of true disruption from the low end here. Today we're doing it with wireline, with municipalities as our customers, and tomorrow we fully expect to do it in the cellular world as well. So thank you very much.
Please welcome Bo Beck, Vice President, Business Development, Ergo Networks.
Hi there. First, just a word about who Ergo Networks is. We are a leader in MIMO OFDM technology. Our founders started in Stanford University, wrote sort of the original papers on concept of something called MIMO OFDM, which I'll explain in a minute, and have basically pioneered the market in developing this very advanced technology into the commercial marketplace. We basically build chipsets, reference design, software firmware that has really radically altered what Wi-Fi is capable of and the applications that it can support. We've introduced our products into the marketplace a little less than a year ago on the retail side, and have been fortunate enough to have a pretty broad adoption in the retail network equipment space and then starting into the PC laptop space, and are moving rapidly into the home networking markets and markets beyond that. MIMO technology, as it was introduced into the retail market, was really the first time in a while that you really saw differentiation in the Wi-Fi space. It's been somewhat stale for a while. 11G was out there. 11A never really got adopted too strongly, and performance was, let's just say, barely adequate for most cases. And a lot of people had these networks deployed in their homes, but couldn't really go to the edge of the homes, had to sit in certain places. A certain chair was off limits, these sorts of things. With Ergo technology, it just radically improved the coverage and the throughput and the robustness of these networks. And we're fortunate that the press and media have widely acknowledged the disruption that MIMO has brought to this space. So, what is MIMO? How did we solve this problem? And it's really nothing short of a fundamental rethinking of the way to do wireless technology. And if you look at any wireless system from as it exists today, whether it's cellular or anything, you basically have a transmitter transmits, That signal bounces off of many objects and reflections in its path. And on the other side, you have a receiver that is out there listening, and it hears the signal from that transmitter, but it also hears many phase-shifted and time-shifted reflections of that signal. That is basically what wireless does. There's no going around it. But for the last 100 years since, Marconi sent his first, wireless signal around a hill, that multipath, those reflections have been viewed as a severe hindrance. And that, everybody in the cellular market and everywhere else has been basically focused on the idea of eliminating those multipath reflections, of filtering them out, rake receivers, whatever you can do to get rid of those reflections and focus on the single strongest signal that you can get a hold of. Well, what the founders of Ergo, theorized and wrote the original papers on and then subsequently developed an actual commercial product is applying MIMO technology together with OFDM to basically look at this problem and figure out that if you actually leverage the multipath that is in the air, you can essentially get a second dimension of sort of capacity and information that you can send through the air, and basically using that in conjunction with multiple transmitters, multiple receivers, with some very sophisticated algorithms, basically pull that data apart and achieve something that was not possible before. And pictorially, if you look at that, this is an example of a typical system. We call it a two transmit and three receive system, where there's on the transmit side you have basically two radio chains transmitting a different modulated signal at the same time on the same channel, basically over each other. And then on the receive side, in our case, you have three receivers. You could do it two, where you basically have three full receive chains where you're listening to the air. Those two independent signals that are obviously mixed as they travel, and you're pulling down this combination of signals. But because you have the three antennas and the two transmitters, you can understand and estimate the channel and understand how that these signals have come across and basically pull those things apart in the air that have come through and break it back down. So in our first product, what you had was the ability of laying two 54 megabit, say G channels or A channels, signals on top of each other and getting 108 megabits per second. What's more, it's not like this is something that was sort of, a fragile add-on that gave you some good data rates up close and sort of broke down quickly as you move forward. This is really something that is both giving you increased capacity, but a greatly increased range and robustness. So we can sustain our connection several times, greater coverage area than any other Wi-Fi device today, and do it in a more robust fashion, because you can imagine three receive antennas are more resilient to any disruptions that might be coming over, one single signal. The this technology that we invented was proposed to the 802.11n task group as the next standard. A year ago, all proposals were made based on this fundamental technology, and now we're going through the last phases of pulling together the 802.11n, the actual final proposal. But one thing that isn't a question is that it's going to be based on this MIMO OFDM technology, which is sort of theoretically and scientifically been proven to be sort of the optimum theoretical way that you can do a wireless system. And you're not limited to two, what are called two spatial streams. You can actually, in the future, envision where you're doing three or four spatial streams. It's just a matter of cost and power consumption and the market need. So, our first product made a pretty big splash. 2 weeks ago, we announced our third generation wireless technology. And this just, again, radically moves the bar forward. We're talking about almost a quarter gigabit physical link rate for a Wi-Fi system. As you can imagine, that will basically allow you something upwards of 120 megabits of TCP/IP throughput. And this is just, basically in a product that is simultaneously packet by packet interoperable with 802.11ABG, but going into these special sort of MIMO modes when there's a product out there that can support it. So clearly, when we look at what we're doing and where we want to go with this, I think we've heard a lot of discussion about the huge investments and the technologies being applied to bringing, high bandwidth through the networks and up to the house. what we're looking at now is, okay, well, now that you're in the house with this heat trap pipe, what are you going to do? You bring your IPTV into the house. How are you going to get it around the house? How are you going to get it from the termination point of that IPTV, which is the DSL thing in the office, to your TV number one and TV two and three? You basically are, you need a network. And there are, some alternatives on a wired basis. Today, in the U.S., Europe is a little more lacking in those cable deployments and things like that that might be considered. But at the end of the day, what you're really looking at is something that has the flexibility to get to a model where you're not rolling trucks, you're not installing filters, you're not knocking holes in walls, where you're just basically plugging it in and delivering, very high throughput anywhere in a typical American, or international household. So we're pretty excited about what this is going to do for this marketplace and moving forward in this area. And we're sampling those now. And what you can see here is the kind of performance difference that we're delivering with our technology. So this is actually taken in a very large mansion, a 6,000 square foot estate up in the Portola Valley. But and what you have is a couple hundred feet of separation between the access point and the farthest room. And you look at typical sort of 802.11 devices are start out okay, and then they struggle to maintain connectivity, let alone any kind of connectivity that will allow you to do things more interesting than data. With the MIMO technology, we're pushing high throughput all the way through to the edges of an enormous house. So we say goodbye cables, and hello to MIMO. So I think that we're on the verge of something very interesting, and it's not just going to be limited to Wi-Fi. MIMO is a technology that I don't think can be stopped from moving into every wireless system out there over a period of time. It's, the advantages and spectral efficiency that you gain, I think, are going to be unstoppable in terms of getting into cellular networks to increase the capacity and the economics of those networks, WiMAX or what have you. So that's where we're going, and thank you.
Please welcome Jeff Lorbeck, Senior Vice President and General Manager, Media Flow, Qualcomm.
For reasons that may be readily apparent to most people in the audience, human beings seem to love audio and video programming. I was shocked to learn some time ago, and I'm sure this is not true of any of the homes represented in the audience, that in the average American home, the television set is running for about 4.5 hours per day. It's a lot of video, a lot of audio. The vision of the Qualcomm Media Flow division is to provide numerous channels of exceptionally high quality video and audio on the wireless handset with an ease of use and intuitive user interface and a price point that enables mass market adoption. Qualcomm began looking at the issues of video and audio distribution many years ago, beginning with the deployments of the third generation wireless packet data network. SK Telecom was one of the first operators in the world to deploy a technology called CDMA 2000 1X EVDO. In fact, they began deploying in the fall of 2001, and by the spring of 2002, they began offering commercial service. One of the services that they offered over the DO network was called the June service, J-U-N-E, June, the month June. The June service offered video on demand, music on demand, and other data services requiring high data throughput. Within about 8 or 9 months, SKT had over 1 million June subscribers on their network that were launching video on demand sessions. Some of the content that proved to be most popular was a simple simulcast of the broadcast soap opera. So at a certain point of time during the day, over 1 million people on SKT's 3G network began to initiate a video-on-demand session of that simulcast of that soap opera. And they found that that type of service offered on-demand was placing a great strain on their networks, on their 3G networks. So as powerful and robust as those 3G networks are and will continue to be, offering music on demand, video on demand, m-commerce, web browsing, and so on, there are some user services that simply do not scale to mass markets. Chief among them for multimedia is the distribution of high-quality video and audio content. So when Qualcomm began to look at this issue of the video and audio delivery to handsets, we considered several years ago other technologies that were being developed to address the same issue. And there is an entire alphabet soup of these technologies. ISDVT in Japan, satellite DMB in Korea and Japan, terrestrial DMB, DDBH, and so on. In all cases, we found that a physical layer, the air interface, could be further optimized by removing the constraints of these legacy technologies and developing a technology from the ground up. And that really is the genesis of the flow technology. We didn't set about to develop a competing technology to the DDBHs and the terrestrial DMBs and so on, but just as in the early days of CDMA, we found that by developing a system from the ground up based upon different engineering constraints and so on, we could radically and fundamentally improve the performance of a multicast distribution network. And I say this with pioneers of the Qualcomm CDMA technology sitting in the audience today. The technology that we have been developing, called the Flow technology, is based on OFDM. That surprises some folks. Here's Qualcomm developing an OFDM technology. OFDM is also used in our CDMA 2000 1X eVideo Platinum. So the Platinum multicast is based upon an OFDM technology. In any event, for these single frequency networks, for this multicast distribution of content, both video and audio, OFDM has proven to be a very good technology for this particular application. The Flow OFDM has been implemented on a chipset, and samples of those chipsets will be available to the handset manufacturers in the fourth quarter of this year. In fact, this morning, Qualcomm announced that it was publicly demonstrating the Flow Air interface over the air onto a handset at CTIA in San Francisco. And I'll be heading there after this. The Flow Forum was launched in July, on July 26th. There were 18 members and 12 memberships pending, and including a half a dozen Tier 1 handset manufacturers who have committed to promulgating the Flow technology through the standards process. A complement to the Flow technology is our MDS, or the MediaFlow Media Distribution System, a client-server solution that, with the Flow Air interface, forms a complete end-to-end solution for the delivery of rich multimedia, including the video and audio content, both real-time streaming and something that we've phrased or coined clipcasting, which is the network distribution of content and the caching of that content on handsets. I like to describe that as somewhat of a DDR function for a wireless phone. So some of the content that can be enjoyed by a subscriber is the real-time streaming content, again, both video and audio, and some of the content can be this cached content. So imagine as a user, there are some times during the day you may have just a few moments available to you to catch up on news, sports, primetime entertainment, and there will be content sitting on your handset and cached, ready to go. A third category of content is the IP data casting. IP data casting is the distribution of arbitrary files, IP files. So anything that can be transmitted over the internet can be sent over the flow air interface. Examples of these data and the applications that can be based upon the IP data casting are idle screens on the user's handset, a wireless subscriber's handset, that can be fully customized to present the subscriber's weather for their city, stock updates for their portfolio, sports scores for their favorite sports teams, and so on. The combination of Flow and the MDS forms this complete end-to-end solution. Now, Qualcomm, in the middle of 2003, acquired UHF channel 55. This is in the lower 700 megahertz of our frequency. So from 716 to 722, it's a 6 megahertz chunk of frequency nationwide. We acquired 5/6 of that spectrum in FCC auction number 49. We paid $38 million for this 5/6 of the U.S., including Alaska and Hawaii and the islands. The last chunk we picked up in a private transaction, and the details of that transaction are under NDA. So we have spectrum nationwide. Last fall, we announced the formation of a wholly owned subsidiary to Qualcomm by the name of MediaFlow USA, Inc., which we abbreviate internally as MUI, or MUI. MUI is in the process today of acquiring leases for broadcast towers throughout the United States. So we've begun the process of deploying transmitters based upon the Flow technology. By the fourth quarter of next year, we'll be launching commercial service over the Flow network. The Flow transmitters are commercial off-the-shelf transmitters that can also be used for DVB-T. It's essentially a software upgrade. It's a download of new code to the field programmable gate array, or FPGA. So these are essentially off-the-shelf transmitters going onto high-powered transmit towers. Our FCC Part 27 for our Channel 55 permits us to use up to 55 kilowatts ERP, or effective radiated power, from each transmitter. As we've done our network planning across the United States in well over 100 markets, we have found that on average, we will require about 3 MediaFlow transmitters per market, compared to hundreds of the wireless BTSs for the 2G and 3G networks. So there's a two-order magnitude difference in the number of transmitters required to provide Flow services, or these rich multimedia services, in a given market. So the Flow network is completely independent of the wireless operator's 3G network, but the two really work hand-in-hand in providing services to the wireless subscribers. So imagine, as a subscriber, you're watching a music video channel and decide to download a ringtone or a wallpaper, or perhaps even the audio or video associated with that music channel. Any of these interactive applications will occur over the 3G network. Now, it's not clear today exactly what consumers will want in terms of a mix of programming on a Flow network. So again, in our 6 megahertz, we can provide about a bit per second per hertz, or about 6 megabits per second, and that includes a significant link margin for mobility and for in-building penetration. So the quality of service, the grade of service, will be similar to the wireless networks, the voice services and other data services provided on the 2G and 3G networks. But in this 6 megabits per second, we can provide up to 20 real-time streaming channels targeted for quarter VGA displays. So QVGA displays are somewhat uncommon here in the United States. They're very common in Asia. They're 320 pixels by 240 pixels, which is about 3 times the number of pixels as the QCIP displays that are currently available here in the U.S. for video services. So in the U.S. today, we have Sprint, who's offering MobiTV and Sprint TV, Verizon, who just launched VCast in February, Singular, who have video services. In all these cases, we're excited by these video services. We think it's building awareness with the content providers, with the wireless subscribers, and throughout the wireless community. However, these services are success limited. Just as the case with SK Telecom offering their June service on this early CDMA 2001X EVDO network in Seoul, these services cannot scale to mass market, these video on demand services, music on demand services, over the current 3G network. If consumers want a lot of content, a lot of numerous channels available to them at high qualities, those type of services cannot be provided over the 3G network for a mass market, for a significant double-digit percentage of the wireless operator subscribers. The MediaFlow USA Inc. business model in the United States is first to deploy this network based upon the MediaFlow technologies, this Flow Air interface, and the MediaFlow media distribution system, as well as to aggregate a core set of basic content. So we've been tracking and closely following the video and multimedia services throughout the world, currently today being offered by the 3G operators, and even those deployments of DVBH and terrestrial DMB and satellite DMB and some of the competing technologies to Flow. Those trials are also of interest to us. It has proven that wireless subscribers are interested in these multimedia services. They desire this video and numerous channels. They want the choice of different channels of content, both the video content and the audio content. But what we don't know today is exactly what that mix will be. So we're working with the content providers. We have this ability to provide these 20 real-time streaming channels of video, 10 real-time streaming channels of audio at HEAAC or AAC+, the parametric stereo, near CD quality of audio, 10 real-time streaming channels, 800 minutes a day of this so-called flipcast content, a content that can be pushed over the network and cached on the handset. Now, it is not the expectation that any subscriber will be watching Flow content or these video and audio services for 800 minutes a day, but this is the amount of content that is available on the network, and based upon the user preferences and their subscription, will be available to them for storage on their handset. And again, that final category of data, the IP data casting, can be used to offer a number of interesting data services and other applications. Today, even with all of the close monitoring of what's happening in the world of wireless and video and audio, and even based upon our own market research, we're beginning to develop hypotheses of what consumers will want on their handsets. And we're finding that across demographics, people want basic news, weather, sports, prime time entertainment, and so on. But we know consumers want choice. And that beyond this basic core set of content, they'll want additional content available to them. And that can be targeted to different demographics and affinity groups. So for example, say that you're a sports fanatic, can't live without your baseball highlights and your football scores and so on. There can be a basic channel of content and then additional premium channels or premium packages. So the flexibility in the bundling of content, not only in the format of the content, whether video and audio, but really in the packaging of these various programs into tiers of services is extremely flexible on the MediaFlow care interface and the Flow network. So that is something that we'll be doing really over the course of many years, is fine-tuning that packaging of content, working with the wireless operators. In fact, some of that content could be user-generated content. So podcasting, blogging, video blogging, becoming popular, those blogs and podcasts could represent some of the capacity on the Flow network. Again, we're targeting a commercial launch in the fourth quarter of 2006. So by the end of next year, there will be a commercial MediaFlow system, a Flow network. We're also taking this MediaFlow story internationally. So we have business development teams active really over the four corners of the earth, Korea, Japan, China, India. What has been very surprising to us has been the interest in the Flow technology, this Flow Air interface, even in Europe. So today there are about a dozen DVB-H and terrestrial DMB trials that we're tracking very closely in Europe. What was surprising to us is that, by and large, the wireless operators, the broadcasters, the broadcast network operators, even the regulators are maintaining a somewhat agnostic stance toward the technology adoption of these multimedia physical layers. So we have multiple requests for demos and trials of a Flow system really throughout the world, and that will be a task that we'll be addressing over this coming year. So stay tuned. By the fourth quarter, again, of next year, we will have a commercial launch of Flow, working with the wireless operators. We are a wholesaler to them. The business model is we will wholesale packages of programming to them on a prescriber per month basis. They'll turn around and retail that Flow service with their other data services and multimedia services. And we envision MediaFlow as being but an element of a broader portfolio of data services and multimedia services. So we'll package that up with other music on demand, video on demand, ringtone download, web browsing services, and then offer that on a retail basis to their subscribers. MediaFlow will have no direct relationship with subscribers. The billing will continue to come through the wireless operator, customer care, handset distribution, and so on. So today, again, FTTIA in San Francisco, we are publicly demonstrating the Flow physical layer with multiple channels of video content. And I encourage any folks who have not seen a demo of MediaFlow on a handset at your earliest convenience in one of the trade shows, or if you happen to be in San Diego, to stop by. It has been without exception that when people see a demo of Flow, they can begin to imagine that consumers will indeed want this mobile TV content on their handsets. And I think that's been, again, true without exception as I've provided the demo. So stay tuned for the launch of MediaFlow in the fourth quarter of next year. Thank you.
Please welcome to the stage David Tenenhaus, VP Corporate Technology Group Director, Research, Intel.
Thank you. Before I get started, I'd like to make a bit of a public service announcement, actually coming out of one of the prior panel sessions. This morning you heard some comments. Somebody asked a question about the VCs paying, you know, a fraction of a percent riding on the back of government-funded research. One of the things that occurred to me as I was sitting here through these sessions is that, in fact, government-funded research pretty much contributed to all three of the technologies you see here, particularly the mesh work, MIMO work with things that were funded by DARPA in the mid-90s. And I'd like to drive this home to folks that government funding, particularly the university research, is pretty critical. We believe this very deeply at Intel. We think, you know, we've got a big R&D budget. We can fund our own research. But it's critical that the government continue to fund university research. This has really diminished in the past few years, and it's a message I'd like you to take home to take back to your organization, the importance of maintaining that path to innovation. It's an absolute key to our productivity in this country, and I hate to see it languish. So getting on with this presentation and this discussion, it was also a bit of a trip through memory lane looking at the session that just preceded this one, where there was a lot of great discussion ending up. I think George mentioned, I think he closed with separation, I think he said, of content and conduits. And the campaign I've been on for over 10 years now really is almost the same words. It's content and carriage. That the decoupling of content and carriage is pretty critical over the long term. And I think that plays in particularly to mobile networks. We'd like to get away from the walled garden approach there over time. And when people ask me about WiMAX, it's easy. There's often this whole, you know, the first thing is, well, you know, WiMAX, 3G, it's all about voice. It's all competitive. And I think they missed the key point. And my assistant was actually too polite to put the key point clearly. It's about the data, stupid, not just it's about the data. And it's really about data having different transmission properties in most cases. IP-based data in particular is very bursty. It really wants a bursty channel. When you want to transmit that PowerPoint, when you want to transmit that MP3 file, you're transmitting a compressed file. You want it to move quickly through the network. You're going to put a burst demand on a network, and you want a network, therefore, that can tolerate burst demands and respond to them, give you that immediate access. Now, most of the time, you're not doing anything. Right? So most of the you're quite happy with the network that gives you perhaps a lower average capacity, but a very high burst capacity. Now, the other property that IP-based data has is it's actually quite tolerant. It's willing to adjust. If the network is a little bit loaded, it will back off, especially if it's TCP/IP based, and it will dynamically share the bandwidth that's available, the capacity available amongst users. And so one of the nice things about WiMAX and Wi-Fi, in fact, is that they give data what it wants. Essentially, they're very nicely tailored to take advantage, both to provide the burst capacity in ways that are just not as fundamental to 3G technologies or any of the prior cell technologies. And they take advantage of this flexibility in a number of ways. And that includes, you know, essentially the OFDM technology doing a very nice job of allowing you to spread the symbols over many subcarriers. That also, by the way, gives you very nice mobility. And really, OFDM, I think everybody's pretty much on target now. It's kind of the way forward in the future for pretty much all of our wireless networks. And it, at the same time, it, you know, techniques like adaptive bit loading allow us to adjust dynamically to the channel to get more capacity or less capacity from the channel, depending on what else is going on in the spectrum at a given point in time. So if it's about the data, and I think even the types of traffic that we just heard about, if you think about media clips, if you think about large, you know, types of audio and video traffic, in general, it's compressed traffic. It, too, is quite bursty and can be transmitted very effectively in bursts. So the second point I wanted to make was just about the getting back to the content and carriage point from the prior session, is this whole issue of having a native IP access channel. The combination of Wi-Fi and WiMAX really give us a native channel. Now, it seems like my animation got lost here. Can you click back, please? And you've kind of spoiled the punchline. A little less aggressive on the key click there, please. If you look here, the chart on the left is showing essentially GSM towers in downtown Seattle. And that looks like a pretty good density. And if you tell you click forward, one click now. Carefully. There you go. And the red shots are just all just driving around, war drivers. Those are the Wi-Fi access points in Seattle. Many of those are private. But now if you imagine those as being, some of them being meshed, and others of them at least being equipped with WiMAX subscriber modules, you can sort of imagine the opportunity here. So we really have this phenomenal opportunity to provide essentially an all-IP direct wireless service. And I think that's just a phenomenal opportunity and the thing that really gets me excited about WiMAX. There's lots of other things that get other colleagues at Intel excited about it for other reasons. But for me, this is the key. It gives us a chance to drive an all-IP access out to consumers at a very, very attractive cost point. So click forward another chart. And just wanted to comment that, again, to my mind, this is all about a much longer-term sort of vision of where are we going with spectrum, where are we going with regulation. Wi-Fi and WiMAX are sort of good points towards the use of, especially of unlicensed bands, both licensed and unlicensed, good points towards moving from this historical pattern where historically we've essentially allocated the spectrum not just in these six tiny chunks, but in a very strange way where we've vertically integrated in the regulatory process the application, the channel over which the application is transmitted, all the modulation and other specs with which it's transmitted, and the specs for the appliances, the radios at both ends. This is a very strange thing to do. Historically, in an analog world, it sort of made sense. In a digital world, it no longer makes sense. And so you really want to think of all this, if we could click forward now, please, as really a further step towards getting a technology-neutral or service-neutral view of the spectrum, or decoupling the content, the carriage, and the appliances that we're using from the spectrum itself and how it's allocated. So those are basically the only comments and points I wanted to make here. I think WiMAX gets a nice step forward towards that, and particularly when you combine WiMAX with Wi-Fi meshes, you get a very, very powerful new technical capability. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Dave. And as we all gather on stage here, let me just continue on your last point there and ask you and the others to comment a bit more on Doug Lockie and Vern Fotheringham's earlier comments about cognitive radio. And, you know, George has been writing about this for 15 years, hoped that spectrum policy would be able to be based on those ideas. Where are we? How realistic? How far out are these cognitive radios? Obviously, there will be an evolution. But how realistic can we be about actually basic policy, spectrum policy, on these technologies, and when can we do so?
Well, I think it's one of these things you have to get to and expect to get to in stages. The radios themselves, software-defined radios, and it's something many of us worked on for a number of years. My group at MIT worked on it 10 years ago. We were not new. We were not the first to the party. There have been others there before. We were probably the second crack by DARPA at it. The technology is, I think, now starting to get to the point where we can be very interested in it. So I think we're going to see more and more agility in how the spectrum is allocated and used. We may see at some point, and I'm not talking from specific knowledge, so I don't want anybody to think that there's some secret Intel deal going on, but we may see individual carriers deciding to own purpose, taking advantage of the ability to manage their own spectrum before we see it fully in all spectrum. But I see a lot of good stepping stones. The FCC agreeing to allow UWB over a very wide spectrum is, I think, a really nice step because it sort of gets out from underneath the view that all of the spectrum at all power levels is one. Now I've got a huge chunk of the spectrum that is very low power levels, sensing on light. So we'll get there in safety.
Dave Mock, the author of several books on wireless, has joined us on stage. Dave, do you have any questions?
One thing in particular, is listening to all the discussion, that struck me is that technically we have a lot of avenues, and it seems like we have a good understanding of how to increase throughput and enable the end consumer to have access to a lot of these forms of media that we're talking about, but I haven't heard, other than Ron made one comment that I keyed on about the economics of it, and he threw out a target there at $15 a month. So I kind of see the technical problem solved in a number of different ways, and this panel is kind of set up to discuss, okay, which one of these is going to win, or who's going to fall out, or are they all going to share that, but I haven't seen any discussion of the economics. We looked at media flow, we looked at different kinds of unlicensed wireless access, offering variety of services, but we're not defining what exactly are those services. Are they all synonymous, and are they all going to be able to reach the price point? We have a current environment where everybody, I think, concedes 3G is too expensive. It's going to come down in price. Is it going to be able to come down in price enough to meet Ron's target? So I'd like to hear some of the input from the panel on that.
I think it's going to have to. I think part of the problem is the major carriers, you know, they need ARPU to keep going up, right, because they need to keep making more money. And, you know, technology like ours is coming along, and, you know, it's going to keep getting better and better. I mean, you know, I whispered over here and said, hey, you know, we're going to use MIMO, too. So you can imagine, you know, 240 megabits of throughput across a mesh network, you know, anywhere in town. For $15 a month, you know, and I think, you know, you threw out six megabits a second, right? So, you know, something's got to give on the ARPU side, and, you know, I guess that's the nature of disruptive technology and disruptive markets. So, you know, I think all of this, you know, coming up from the bottom in this open standard radio is really probably the best opportunity for ARPU to come down and services to improve in the process.
I would agree. I think two of the barriers you have there are sort of a lot of the traditional equipment, particularly the base station equipment, was very gold plated. I think the WiMAX Wi-Fi type of equipment simply isn't. So there's a huge drop in price there. And the costs of manufacturers aren't, by even open standards, the cost of manufacturers aren't artificially inflated by large royalties. Choose at the pot, how to get the cost down.
Right, and I think I'd add, yeah, as these innovations start making their way into the marketplace where, you know, you bring the benefits of MIMO-OPM into the space, if you're looking at deploying a network, it's, you know, what's your density, how many customers can you serve, how much area can you cover in a more rural, less dense area, how many, you know, towers do you have to deploy there, you know, and in the dense areas, how many additional units do you have to deploy in order to cover, you know, the peak loads and things like that. And so as these new technologies, you know, bring the cheap dumps in special efficiency, you know, whatever the ROI equation was, it just got better by, you know, a factor of, you know, four. So twice as far with twice the capacity, that's a more attractive. I grew up in the Ethernet world. You know, I was at Freightcom for 10 years, and we were very fond of the saying that, you know, good enough beats best. And, you know, back in the day, token ring, APM, you know, was all arguably better technology, you know, deterministic, and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, Ethernet was 10 times as fast and a tenth the price and took over the world. And I think we're seeing the start of that in you know, with open standard radio. And, you know, you get enough Wi-Fi out there, you get enough mesh out there in WiMAX, you're going to see the same phenomenon. Good enough is going to be best. And that's going to drive cost.
My response might be a different dimension of the same question. But globally, as operators have deployed multimedia services and video services, there seems to be a $10 or $15 price point that wireless subscribers are willing to pay on top of their other voice services and basic data services. For example, the VCAPS is $10 a month, and Sprint TV is a combination of 10 for 10 for Sprint Vision and 15 for Sprint TV, or vice versa. The market research and the trials in Europe for DVB-H has indicated, you know, like the 10-pound range, or equivalent in the U.S. of 10 or 15. In general, people are not willing to pay a cable TV-sized bill to have their multimedia content on the handset. So it has to be, you have to be able to deliver these services at a much lower price point than would be possible on a 3G or a mass market.
I can guess that Ron's probably next response. He and I were at a wireless voice over IP conference just a few weeks ago. And it was a very timely conference where we talked about now you're talking about Wi-Fi and wireless mesh entering into the voice realm. And now you're talking about disrupting what is the basis of a lot of carriers. Basically their lifeblood at this point. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but I was going to add another twist to this, is that I see the current way we achieve service through the service providers, and there's a big elephant in the room and all this, is there's an ecosystem built around the delivery of service. I don't see that ecosystem yet built around open standard radio to the degree it is, obviously, with the carriers who control all that. They develop content delivery, and that seems to be the way that Qualcomm's going with media flow, that you have your content delivered and all that aggregated together. I don't see how that's going to be done on an open Wi-Fi basis. And to give you an example, Ron, you had a slide up there about this Wi-Fi phone you'll be able to use in a mesh here, let's say in the Bay Area, and if you go to China, the mesh system they have there, it'll work there too. But there has to be a roaming agreement behind that, a billing agreement. That's the kind of ecosystem I'm talking about.
You know, the world's biggest content ecosystem lives around the Internet and TCP/IP. You know, we're talking about a native, Internet connection anywhere in town. You can stream video across it. You can do voice over IP across it. You can search Google Maps, et cetera. I mean, what is more rich than that? Oh, by the way, for $16 a month, right? So, yeah, we have to work out roaming agreements, et cetera. But, you know, Boingo and others, you know, there's many people working on solving that problem. So I'd argue that there's no richer source of streaming content and of content in general than using Wi-Fi to connect to the Internet over TCP/IP. And the roaming is happening just in a different way. I deal with the service that actually then in turn deals with all of those other practical services. Excuse me, roaming. Yeah. So we're deployed in Chaska, Minnesota, and we hope to be deployed in Minneapolis sometime in the next 6 months. I'll bet you that, within 6 months there's a roaming agreement between, Minneapolis and Chaska, because guess what? The users are going to demand it, and Boingo just steps in and provides it. So.
What kind of a time frame do you guys see on that? Because I think that's kind of critical. There's a lot of talk about the lead that 3G would have in providing ubiquitous broadband service compared to that.
I mean, if the cable guys jump in the way I think they will in the metro-scale Wi-Fi, it'll be done by the end of next year. Because there's only six cable operators that have to figure out how to roam together, and that's not hard.
I don't know if there's other questions.
I've got a sort of technical question for Bo. What has your research shown about the applicability of MIMO in the sort of outdoor wide area network? Obviously, there's not usually as much multipath. Is it a no-go for MIMO in the wide area? Are there some areas where it might be useful and others not? What's sort of the latest research on that?
Yeah, right. So the good thing, when MIMO's first papers were written and people started speculating about, okay, well, you depend on this multipath, so what if you're outdoors or, you're not going to have enough multipath? It was good to find out or prove out that there's really almost no environment that you can conceive of that doesn't have enough multipath to sustain two channels, but most likely four channels. I'm talking about four spatial streams. So, in the home, it's obviously great for a multipath environment, but outdoors, you have enough balance and ground balance to be able to do those, to do the MIMO rate as well. But the only thing, if you're really trying to go fixed point for miles away with very directional antennas, that's a little less. You're basically architecting around the multipath for a very specific purpose. But I think
outdoor metro networks where you're trying to spread services to, you know, into homes or to municipal leads or whatever. That's all.
Is it going to be possible to put that many antennas on a handset?
Yeah. So obviously, there's a lot of antennas on. Are you talking about like a cell phone application now?
Right.
Yeah. So you know, they're cramming a lot of antennas on there now. You know, this you probably would go with a more simple, maybe a two receive, you know, version. Maybe even only one upstream. Go MIMO down or receive combining down, and do those sorts of things. But you know, we have in our cartridge card today a very very small separation between our antennas. It's 1.9 lambda in terms of wavelength, and that is fine. So you know, if you can find a space in the cell phone, I don't think technically you'll be limited.
This is one great advantage of laptops. There's lots of room for antenna diversity. Just in case the audience doesn't realize, it's not whether you can cram the antenna in, it's you need to space the antenna, but there needs to be some space between.
Ideally, you want it to be a half a wavelength or more, so that means, you know, somewhere between, I don't know, 3 and 6 centimeters for a 2.4 gigahertz or 5 gigahertz. So that's all great in a laptop, but even if it's less than that, kind of.
So it'll fit in one of those things.
Yeah,
one of those.
Stephen Sprague from Wave Systems. I really enjoyed Jeff's presentation about the UFO. I've been not paying attention to the UFO. And as a company that spent a lot of time building infrastructure for data casting over the terrestrial television infrastructure, I have a technical question for you, but then I have a broader question, which is, so one of the things he brings up is that they found insufficient bandwidth in the existing 3G networks for the delivery of mass media content to simultaneous users, and therefore they're deploying broadcast. And that's in essence what data casting across the network is, if I understand correctly what you said. And so I'd like to understand what other people thought in the Wi-Fi infrastructure is, including some capacity within the Wi-Fi network as it grows in capacity to support a data cast model. Because the Super Bowl on a streaming basis sucks, to be very blunt. Because if everybody in town watches, then the capacity of the servers, the capacity of the pipes, the capacity of the head end all fall apart, and that's why we have cable and terrestrial television. I find it fascinating that that sort of picture is coming back around. Having been a huge proponent of data casting storage and metering of content for years at Wave Systems. And the second question is, one of the biggest challenges we found in terrestrial data casting, and we did it with half a dozen public broadcasting stations and a bunch of others, is that there's a reason that cable exists. UHF bandwidth for data casting on mobile bases is really bad. Now, that was off of the terrestrial protocol. So I'd love to understand the technical answer to how your experience has been as you roam a handset around a city off a terrestrial television channel with 5 UHF. And you actually did.
Yeah, so second part first. We are using the 716 to 722, in other words, UHF channel 55, but not ATSC or NTSC. So we're developing a completely new air interface, a new physical layer based on OFDM that's specifically designed for the multicast of multimedia data to mobile devices. So again, it's OFDM based, but it's targeted for that application. So all of the time diversity and frequency diversity required for mobility and so on is baked into the technology. And our current drive testing, it's actually somewhat of a boring demo. Because if I show you a demo sitting here in this room of content on a quarter VGA display with a media flow program guide, it's exactly that same demo when you drive around. And that is the problem with the terrestrial TV standards and mobility. Whether it's NTSC or ATSC, there are mobility problems, power consumption, but it's just simply not built for, it doesn't have the robustness as a physical layer to allow for the uninterrupted reception without all the static and the drop frames and packets and so on. The first part is that, so the current wireless data networks are unicast. So there's a one-to-one connection between the network and the user. So if you have a million people in Seoul logging on and initiating a video on demand session of a soap opera, it's a tremendous load on the network. Now, future the 3G networks will evolve with multicast standards for both 3GPP and 3GPP2. In fact, I mentioned CDMA 1000, 1X EVDO. There's a DO Gold and a DO Platinum. And DO Platinum includes a new OFDM air interface. And multicast for live streaming will help to relieve some of the network strain because it's a one-to-many distribution. But even there, the economics of flow with, say, two or three transmitters in a major metropolitan area will be much better and more attractive than the distribution over a wireless network or a 3G wireless network. And as whether it'll be Wi-Fi capacity, I'll defer to my colleague.
Can you restate that part of the question?
We're supporting multicast, IP multicast, in our Wi-Fi mesh systems today. You know, there's another data point that, you know, and we talk to hundreds of prospects around the world. You know, I get 50 requests for voice over Wi-Fi for every one request I get for, you know, TV over Wi-Fi. So, you know, from my perspective, there's a lot more energy in the market focused on making this thing work at, you know, $20 a month. Rather than TV. I'm sure that'll evolve over time.
But I think this comes back to the long tail discussion from last night. Essentially, I think the Wi-Fi and WiMAX suite of technologies is a highly personalized information service. They'll do other parts of the long tail where it's small scale multicasting. But, you know, basically, if you want television, we have television channels. And if, you know, demand picks up, then people that have those channels will simply change their modulation techniques and, you know, bring the MP4 stream. I think it'll be pretty straightforward. So I'd expect that to just get dealt with by the market.
Great. Thank you so much.
Join us in welcoming to the stage John Kish, President and CEO of Wyse Technologies.
Other than with the sign at lunch that you saw today, how many of you have heard of Wyse Technologies? Okay, Wyse is a company that's been around for about 25 years and is the market leader with about a 40% worldwide market share in something called thin computing, which is effectively trying to produce the simplest possible edge device you can for the enterprise. So what we produce, and you can see some brochures out there, are solid-state simple computers. By that I mean there are no hard drives, there are no fans, there are no moving parts of any type. And they are used by corporations to allow users to access centrally managed applications and centrally managed services. Enterprises use these all over the world. If you go to most banks, you'll see them in the teller systems. If you go to your favorite large retail store, you'll see them running their point-of-sale devices, et cetera, et cetera. To give you scale, we sell about 1.5 million of these a year. So
One of the things that we are doing is attempting to continue to push this idea of what it means to produce a simple computer. As I said before, we've stripped out the hard drive, we've stripped out the moving parts, and what we're about to do, and we'll be launching here over the next couple of weeks, is we're going to strip out the flash memory as well. So these devices will be completely naked when they're brought in and put on a network, and will rely upon the network to actually give them identity. So when the device is turned on, the network will stream down the operating environment and the application stubs that are necessary to give the device its temporary identity. When it's turned off, there'll be nothing left on the device at all. As you might imagine, a lot of companies are interested in this because these devices are much easier to manage than personal computers. Why? If you don't like what's going on the device, you turn it off. When you turn it back on, the device is effectively rebooted with the necessary information that it has for that particular user. Now, as I said before, we have done this for the enterprise. We sell these. We've been selling them for a long time. And we are now in the process of taking that same device and reducing it to a simple chip. So there will, in the second quarter of next year, be thin client devices or simple computing devices that rely upon the network for everything that will be reduced down to a single silicon footprint. Those single chips are going to be moved very, very rapidly into wireless and consumer-based markets. So the goal here that WISE has and will continue to have is to figure out what we have to do to simplify the device at the very edge of the network. By simplify here, I mean strip out everything that it doesn't need to have so long as you have a network on the back end capable of supporting it. That technology is currently being moved into PDAs, and we are currently in the process of moving it into handsets, where you will have not only wireless technology and the bandwidth necessary to do streaming and other things, but you'll actually have a full-blown computer that will sit resident on a single chip that will be able to allow end users to interact with that network as if they were sitting at a PC. The interesting part of all this, of course, is that what we're doing is we're enhancing user experience by giving them access to applications and software which is completely network resident. So unlike many of the computing paradigms that we've seen in the past, where the goal was to execute as much software as possible on the edge device, WISE has taken a very different approach and is working today with customers and in the future with consumers who are interested in looking at a new paradigm where the software will be executing centrally and the edge device will be nothing more than a window into that network. We believe that the implications for this are profound. It will enhance the handset experience by giving people access to more types of information and more services than they've ever had before. And I look forward to discussing that with you more later on. With that, as an introduction, I would like to introduce Aaron, who's going to take us through their particular point of view. Thank you.
Give me a minute to set up, see if technology works. Programmable gate arrays and structured ASICs that we term hard copy. So first, let's talk about a little bit on what's happening in the wireless space. So this is a chart that KDDI, who is the second largest operator in Japan, has put together. And from their view, and this is the most shared view now, the future network, the wireless network, is a heterogeneous network. So it's got a combination of things like a CDMA 2000, could be Rev-A, the platinum component of it. You'll have the Wi-Fi, fiber to the home, all these different ways of accessing the network. And so the network itself needs to be adaptive enough to be capable of taking whatever the access point is and the underlying technology and being able to provide a, seamless user interface. So then let's dive into a little bit of the heart of a wireless network, and that's the base station. Looking at this chart here, or this plot diagram, the blue areas represent the functions where FPGAs or our devices can be utilized. And traditionally, if you were to look at a 2G base station, you'd see a lot of those blues being performed by DSPs, ASSPs. If you go into a 3G base station, you'll still see a lot of that stay with DSPs. You'll see a lot of FPGAs come in, and then you also see ASICs still in there. Now, if you look at a future base station, right, again, show this here. Yep. So you can see that the technology starts bringing in OFDM into the channel card. And so as you bring that, you need to be capable of replacing any of these cards that go from either a Wi-Fi or a WiMAX or a OFDM or a cellular network channel card, and your network needs to be capable of addressing that. So the question is, great, that's typically been the realm of DSPs. Do you guys really think FPGAs are going to take on some of the DSP areas? There's a question. BDCI is a company that does a lot of benchmarking for DSPs and compares that to other devices. And basically, what they showed was anytime you have a need for massive throughput, right, huge performance requirements, very low cost. Now, FPGAs, a lot of you will be thinking low cost and FPGAs don't go together. But overall, if you look at the throughput and the cost per bit, the FPGAs definitely have a 1 to 2 orders of magnitude advantage over any other technology that's out there. The immaturity lies in the FPGAs typically were used more by hardware engineers. DSPs were designed by software engineers. And so the tools that we've developed in the past targeted the hardware engineers, and so the software engineers feel that that's really not relevant to how they actually design. So let's take a look at that. A traditional FPGA design flow, typically what happens is, this is very similar to ASIC. The difference here is we have very complex tools that take a lot of the verification and just make it innate into that tool. So you start with a specification, you do some development of your custom logic, you do verification, you do the synthesis. All along, you're doing your power analysis to make sure that you know you can still work within the power budgets or the power constraints that you have. And in the end, you end up having a product where, like before, like you do some software and hardware debug, right, before you actually have a product that's out there. And through that, you can have IP cores that are done by yourself or a third party. As you move this into the system level, what happens is you take a higher level language approach, and what you do is you have the hardware-software interface, and that's defined in a seamless manner where you can have a lot of IP reuse. Right? So there's a lot of IP libraries that are being developed in-house, and you want to have we want to have the capability to support that seamlessly regardless of what project the engineer is working on. Additionally, there's a lot of embedded soft processors, and so these processors that we have in-house that can be integrated and are very versatile, and they help a lot of the DSP type of approaches. And then you go down into through the system integration and back through the normal back-end flow, which the tool then would take over. So this allows the designer now to have a very high-level language entry and then run it all the way through into a hardware platform. So the assertion here would be that FPGAs can be used as processors or coprocessors. There's a lot of C-level activity that can be done, C language that's written targeted towards FPGAs, and they can work in conjunction with DSPs or general-purpose processors, or they can work on their own. So the area on the left shows the coprocessor approach, where basically you may have a form of DSP, but instead of having 24 DSPs doing some voice processing and data processing, you can bring that down into like maybe 6 DSPs that are doing a lot of the control functions, have 2 or 3 FPGAs. And so there was a lot of conversation earlier about bringing the cost of the network down. That's one easy way of bringing the cost of the network down. You can also bring in things like custom instructions that allow specific parts or areas that have high cycle counts in terms of the CPU performance and make that go much faster. Or you can do a lot of the data transformation
which allows for higher throughput through hardware acceleration. So that's kind of how FPGAs can be utilized, and we see a lot of play from FPGAs and also structured ASICs into the wireless world. Stepping back a little bit, if we look back in time, in the 70s, the semiconductor market, right, through the decade of the 70s, grew to about just over $10 billion. It was dominated by companies that basically had a lot of vertical integration in their own. So these guys did the CAD tooling, the engineering, all the way out to the test equipment, creating their own test equipment, and having their own fabs. And the 80s brought in some specialization. So you had companies like Mentor that had CAD tools they offered. You started seeing the likes of Amkor and TSMC now come in and take over some of the packaging aspects as well as the foundry aspects. And you really had the ASIC methodology as a dominant mechanism of how semiconductor was manufactured. And the market now has gotten just over $50 billion. In the 90s, the outsourcing phenomena is in full fledged. So you have guys like TSMC becoming the dominant foundry houses. And we also see companies such as Broadcom and TNT Sierra and all these other high flyers during the late 90s start to drive a lot of the ASSP approach. So then you get into, and the market, by the way, grew over $200 billion. So there's a large leap in between. So what's in the 2000s? 2000s, we're about halfway through the decade. We're starting to see a lot of standard product requirements, but there's a lot of requirements to make it customized. So as I showed earlier, you have a heterogeneous network, right? Great. You want to have standard products because you want to have the lowest cost, but you also want to have common components because you want to lower your R&D costs and your maintenance costs, and so you want to have some customization capabilities. So from our perspective, what we see is FPGAs and structured ASICs, which are the hard copy devices, have started seeing a lot of growth in this marketplace. There's a lot of ASSP vendors now that are using, for example, our hard copy as their own chip means, and so they go to market on our platform. The other products, such as the CPUs, the DSPs, they continue to have their path, but what will propel the growth in the 2000s will be what we call these customized standard products. So why is that? Simply, there's huge chip development costs. I'm sure a lot of people here who are in the VC community can attest to this. As you move forward in time, the 90 nanometer node requires a $30 million investment before you can come out with a chip. And as you go to 65 nanometer and 45 nanometer, you're starting to see greater than $40 or $50 million in just an investment to get a device out, an ASIC or an ASIC. So how big is the market to support that level of investment? So you have to invest $30 million in a chip in the 90 nanometer node. And if you assume that, you know, you really don't want to spend more than 20% of your revenue on R&D, then as a OEM that's doing this ASIC, you need to see $150 million of revenue for that chip alone. Or if you're an ASSP vendor and you thought that you could hit a market and, you know, in a reasonable 3 to 4 year time frame, get a 10% share of the market, you need to see a market size of $1.5 billion for that single chip. Taking away the cell phone, which definitely can't support that level of size, there's not a whole lot of other industries that can support $1.5 billion to go invest $30 million in just a device. So we see this as a huge play in favor of programmable logic products as well as trusted ASIC products. So just in summing, FPGAs are positioned for growth, as I said earlier. The other semiconductor technologies are coming under high pressure. ASIC design starts are really the a testament to the higher cost that I showed you earlier. And the ASSPs, there's fewer ASSPs. They're in niche markets, and these are, well, you can say niche, they're really high volume markets, but the general market, you're really not going to go create an ASSP for it. And what we're seeing is FPGAs are taking in place today for volume production. It was interesting to see the gentleman from Tropos who brought in the network that he has, and the antenna that he showed was the Motorola canopy. And if you open that box, and this is something we've gone public with, you see the only Logic device in there is an Altera CPA. And that's a very flexible structure because you use that same box on the receive side as a modem when you're home, or on the transmit side, you cluster them for making a base station. So there's a lot of traction of FPGAs in the marketplace, and a lot of that has to do with the flexibility that I've shown below. That's my introduction.
Marco Thompson, CTO, Wind River Services.
How many people in the audience are not engineers? Good. Okay. So I was told that I ought to tell a joke. So actually the joke was on me on my way up here. I decided I would roam my Wi-Fi at the San Jose Airport. I've got one of those $40 a month programs from Starbucks/T-Mobile. But wouldn't you know it, Boingo at San Jose Airport doesn't roam with T-Mobile. At least I couldn't figure out how to do it. So I'm hoping the guys on the previous panel are listening. Those guys have been around for a couple of years, and they still haven't figured out how to roam together. I'm a little worried about that future prediction. On the invitation, I was tasked with talking about embedded in the wireless world. How many people in the audience don't know what embedded means or what an embedded device is? Oh, come on, I don't believe you. I'm going to call on one of you to provide a definition if I don't see some hands here. It's meant a lot of different things to a lot of people in the past. A long time ago, embedded meant real time. For instance, your anti-lock braking system in your vehicle had to sense the rotation of the wheel. It had to make adjustments to the braking depending on whether the wheel was locked or not. Your toaster is an embedded system. Your microwave oven is an embedded system, but also a digital flight control on the deck of a 777 is an embedded system. And the definitions have changed over the years. In the early days, a cell phone was clearly an embedded system. It accepted a couple of numbers, it placed a call, it maintained the call quality, it hung up at the end. Today, I'd be hard-pressed to call a Brew or a Java-based cell phone an embedded system. And one of the most recent definitions that I think works relatively well is that an embedded system has no end-user installable software in it. So think about that as we go through this presentation. A quick background, Wind River is in the embedded systems business, building tools and operating systems that live inside these embedded devices. It's the largest business in the world, and I'm from Wind River Services, and that's the group at Wind River where we actually implement these devices, where we actually build gadgets, fun stuff like satellite television set-top boxes, access points for the wireless industry, digital cameras, networking gear, routers, bridges, hubs, etc., industrial things. And that's the background that we come from. So there's an interesting quote. By the year 2010, the Internet will have trillions of users it doesn't have today. And you're sitting there going, wait a minute, the population of planet Earth is only 5 or 6 billion. The interesting continuation of that is that most of them will not be human beings. And this is from Harbor Research, one of the organizations that follows the machine-to-machine trend in the embedded space, which I think is the most interesting thing going on right now in the embedded business and in the wireless business in general. This is an area that will spark huge growth over the next 10 years. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about things that connect to sensors, things that take that information through the Internet or to some other data collection back-end system, and things that allow an action or a control point to happen based on the information collected. So some examples of these are telematics. There are cars out today that actually have a wireless connection using cell phone technology, data over cell phone technology, that sense through your internal bus on your vehicle whether the car needs to go to the service shop or not. Sends the information to a back-end service, which collects that information and actually calls your Audi dealer or your BMW dealer and tells him to call you and bring the car in. Very interesting sorts of new service models and business models. Asset tracking. The refrigerator trucks on the road today. In fact, Qualcomm has a division that does this. There are a number of other competing firms. Refrigerator trucks, if the refrigerator fails while the truck is at a stop out in the middle of Timbuktu, it actually calls for help and actually not only notifies the driver, but notifies the network of its problem. In offices and in building automation, there are huge trends in wireless adaptations of heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems, security, lighting systems. It turns out that thermostat on your wall traditionally only cost $10 or $15, but drilling the hole, dragging the wire to the control point is a $75 problem. If you could put that $15 thermostat on the wall and wirelessly communicate that the same way Wi-Fi gets to your Wi-Fi access point, wouldn't it be nice not to have to pull a wire for every light switch and every thermostat in every building? The value stack on these devices is similar to the value stack in the cellular phone business, where it's not all about the handset. It's all about the network. It's all about the services offered on top of that. The value-added services in the machine-to-machine space are things like a virtual heating, ventilation, air controller, or air conditioning controller that's not in your building. For instance, all that information is collected in this building. Get transported over the internet to a remote site, which using best practices makes that decision and then sends back the information to your control systems, so that you don't have to have a Honeywell guy bring out a $15,000 change in your control system every time air conditioning technology changes. There's another interesting similarity in the vehicle location business. There's a very interesting company in San Diego called Drive OK. And what they've done is they've taken a GPS, hardwired it, they stick it in your teenager's car, and it remotely tracks the kid, and you can set a geofence for your teenager online, and you can say, if that teenager goes east of I-5 and north of I-8 or whatever, I want to hear about it, and the back-end service will email you, page you, call you, fax you, knock on your door if that kid is outside of his allowed geofence. So, interestingly enough, there are a lot of different technologies that come to play here. It turns out that, there are a couple of key things. There's a power budget. There's a range issue. There's coverage issues for these things. You can think, for instance, there are oil and gas sensors out there in these remote fields all over North America. And these things have solar panels to power them. They have thousands of dollars of equipment at risk there. They communicate via satellite connections. So that's one end of the spectrum. And on the other end of the spectrum, there's that thermostat. When you sticky tape that to the wall, you put a coin cell in it, you expect it to last for 5 years, 5 years of thermostat readings. And you expect it to be very expensive. If you're going to save that $75 wire, that whole system has to be a $15 or $20 system. There's a huge range there in cost, power, and the range of these systems. So, as we all know, there are technologies that can be deployed for these machine-to-machine links. There's the wireless LAN technology. There's wireless personal area networks. All of these networks can be used to deploy machine-to-machine applications. There's wireless sensors and control networks. These are things like Zigbee, Z-Wave, and other purpose-built telemetry networks. There is cellular data. All the different standards in cellular can be used to transport that data a longer distance. And then, of course, there are the satellite networks that can be used to deploy to the remote regions. So the big picture, though, is when you're building these devices, I hate to simplify it, but the wireless is just the link. All the rest of the conversations we've been hearing today are all the great buzzwords in the wireless itself. But the reality is that these devices need device management. They need security. they need application tools to develop them. And so this is where Wind River has focused our view of the marketplace. These gadgets, whether they're $5 gadgets or $10,000 gadgets, they have a certain set of requirements that they need for the developers to be able to develop and test these products. They need to be able to have these tools. This is a quick picture of the different ways that this information gets back to the back end, back to the services play. Some of these things, some of these machine-to-machine interfaces, the data is collected inside a building behind a firewall, and the information stays behind the firewall in the building. In some of these business models, for instance, CardioNet is a San Diego-based company that uses Qualcomm technology. It's essentially a sensor, a human sensor, a body sensor, that when you're having cardiac arrhythmia, actually places a phone call, sends the data to your cardiologist, and also gives you a vibration alert on a cell phone-like device that you're wearing. All that data is at your cardiologist when you call in and say, what do I do, or when they call you. So there are different ways of connecting this data back. There are models which take us through the Internet. There are models that keep us behind the firewall. All of these have some sort of a back-end service infrastructure which will allow us to look at that data, to make decisions with that data, and to communicate it. So my 30-second commercial on Wind River, I'll show you two slides here. The first slide is the stack. It's the Wind River and its partners are in a long food chain. That at the bottom of the stack is the operating system, either VxWorks or Linux, and all the tools necessary to create these products. And on the next sheet, for those technical people in the audience that like iCharts, those are your four-letter acronyms. This is the layer cake specifically for consumer products. We have a similar layer cake for network products, industrial products, automotive products, etc. These are the pieces that you need in order to be able to fully manage your wireless machine-to-machine devices. Thank you. Nick, this, Dave and Nick, this is your area, so I'm going to let you go for it.
Machine-to-machine communication. And I wonder if you might have a little more insight into growth in that area of the market. I remember looking into it quite a bit. It was probably 4 or 5 years ago. And if people expected there to be an explosion, I mean, you talk about trillions of devices on the Internet. Obviously, that should open some eyes in terms of investing and venture capital and you know, retail investors. But it seems to me it's kind of in the background. I don't see any major publications. And maybe it's because there hasn't been a lot of talk about the value that it provides. So basically, ROI, what's the ROI in M2M, and where is Wind River finding its value now that that wireless key is there to open up all these opportunities?
I think that the wireless key, or wireless is explosion. And in fact, I started a company in this area. I'm with Wind River as my day job, and I've also started a half dozen companies. So I started a company in 99, specifically in this area, and that company, we sold it about a year ago with not a great outcome, specifically because the wireless technology that we based on was not ready for prime time. With the new Zigbee and other low-cost, reliable, short-haul wireless networks, and the network mesh software that comes with Zigbee, there's a whole new opportunity to build these systems that will be scalable and reliable. But back to the original question, which is, when are we going to see that big application? I'm not sure I can answer that question. I've seen many applications, many of which I think can be nice niche markets. You know, changing the way people build buildings, from every light switch becoming a Zigbee point, every thermostat being a Zigbee point, every light being controlled by a Zigbee network, you know, there could eventually be 100 Zigbee points in this room. And I think that's going to come. It's going to come over the next 5 years. Can't tell you who the leader's going to be that's going to bring that to you, but I can tell you that it's changing the economics in new buildings, and it's changing the economics when people are going in and retrofitting large spaces, how they just, whether they actually drag the cable through the wall.
There's one key to that, go back to energy, I mean, basically battery power. If we're talking about putting a wireless sensing point or a wireless control point sprinkled throughout the house, is the battery technology at a point, and is Zigbee low enough power to keep that running for 10, 15, 20 years of the life of the building?
Right. The key numbers when people install systems, it seems to be 5 years. They want to know they don't have to change that battery for 5 years in an industrial setting or in an office sort of a setting. And they actually, their standard battery technology with Zigbee transmitters, depending on how often you sense something, can get past that five-year point. In fact, something like a wall thermostat, you typically only sense every couple times an hour. Something like a light switch is only when it changes do you have to actually report in to the network. So with the different usage metrics of these different sensor points, many of these things are now enabled by batteries to last for 5 years and beyond.
But if you know, there are going to be trillions of devices on this network. RFID is obviously a key application. Does Wind River play in that emerging field?
Wind River plays in that field in that it has helped design some of the readers for RFID, and some of the software that Wind River sells has wound up in those systems. But I wouldn't say it's a vertical that Wind River has attacked. And those systems are a key component of the whole machine-to-machine space. The ability, actually RFID has gone well beyond the barcoding idea. And RFID now, if each of you were wearing an RFID badge, a simple infrastructure in this room could point out which table each of you are sitting at. So location is now inherent in RFID. And that sort of asset tracking in a warehouse, you can imagine the value in a warehouse or other industrial the sorts of environments where you have a $10 or $15 or $20 tag, which has location as part of its capability.
Marco, your last slide had this giant layer cake of all the stuff that you guys have for this. You're going to deliver that on a trillion devices. What's the revenue model for that?
Interestingly enough, Wind River's revenue model historically to sell VxWorks was to try to get, anywhere from, let's see, in the old days when it was real-time control, it would be $20 or more. Then when we got into satellite set-top boxes and cable TV boxes, it became $1 or 50 cents. And in other applications, it became 10 cents or a nickel in a hi-fi system. So, believe it or not, there's a lot of hi-fi systems and televisions today with a million lines of C code in them. So it's come down and down, and over time, Wind River's value add has been in the tools and in the test benches to create these things more than in the binary, more than in trying to get a penny or a nickel or a dollar per unit. It's been more about enabling the developers. The challenge in these markets is time to market, and it's in development productivity.
So that's why Linux is right there on the bottom of that stack with VxWorks, and that you don't
We're more than happy to have our customers either pay us to use
VxWorks or to get Linux for free. There are different capabilities when you get the one you paid for versus the one you get for free. There are more better supported drivers and other things around VxWorks than there are around Linux. But if you have your mindset towards not paying a royalty, there's a way to do it using our tools.
Actually, I mean, I'd like to ask that question of all of you, maybe you too. Who is going to win the OS wars in wireless devices? And you can divide that into categories and say for these categories, well, I mean, your answer is obvious, but for all those devices, you know, who's going to win and why?
Perhaps I'll take
the I don't want to know what OS you're running anyway.
Well, in point of fact, at least in the enterprise, our company sells, I think it's about 7 or 8 different operating environments. I would say for customers for whom cost is a concern, obviously Linux is one of the ones that they're looking at right now. But we have proprietary operating systems, et cetera. Our goal as a company is really to provide a general purpose computing environment. And to put that within any footprint that people want to use it, whether that's on a desktop, whether that's in a handset, whether that's on the back of a monitor. The choice of operating environment there really is determined by the particular sort of the enterprise infrastructure or the more global infrastructure that people are using. If you want speed, you don't use Microsoft operating systems. Anybody here who's booted Windows XP lately will understand what I mean. If you want something which gives you a lot of flexibility, you may choose to go with an operating environment that is that flexible. But from our point of view, it's really about putting general purpose computing environments into any footprint. One of those footprints will be using the ever-increasing wireless bandwidth that we've heard about all day today. If I could just add one thing. If you look at the highest volume wireless devices today, they're cell phones. And cell phones have a whole litany of operating systems most of you have never heard of. Some of you have heard of Symbian. Some of you may have heard of TI's OMAP. Some of you may have heard of other internal names. You know, Nokia's got 3 or 4. But most of you don't know what operating system is in your cell phone, although some of you know that you have Java or Brew on your cell phone. That's a new trend. In the future, when we're talking about these billions and then trillions of connected devices, it almost won't matter. I mean,
maybe you can divide it into two categories, those things that have a user interface and those that don't. So if it has a user interface...
Those things that don't have a user interface, I think, will be dominated by homegrown operating systems, where somebody writes 1,000 lines of code to do the very simple functions necessary in the device. Or, you know, Microsoft has CE, Wind River has VxWorks and Linux. Those are by far the three most deployed today. There are hundreds of millions of copies of VxWorks out there. CE is mostly in the user interface world. It's not in the deeply embedded world. And Linux is just becoming a deeply embedded world.
What about ARM?
Well, ARM is a processor standard that'll run any one of the mentioned operating systems, with the exception of XP, which requires
F86. I was just going to make a comment. I think Microsoft is the antithesis of the thin client or embedded system. We've just seen one of their major successes a couple days ago with getting it onto the Trio. And that's been after years of work at trying to penetrate wireless devices. Ultimately, that's kind of one of my worst fears is to see XP on this thin, simple function device because it just won't work. So I kind of see a lot of variety of different vendors, Linux, as well as Wind River and the tool builders that build a very thin, very efficient operating system that does a limited amount of tasks. I think when you're talking about something like a cell phone or a smart device that is going to interface with your Microsoft Exchange servers or any of the functions that you already have Microsoft systems established in, we're going to see some penetration there. But certainly in the type of stuff we're talking about, where we're talking about a trillion devices, very small, very cost efficient, it's completely out of the realm of Microsoft. We're going to see probably a new breed of OS companies coming in too, working into that area.
Well, there are companies, one called Dust, I believe, that promoted the idea that things the size of Dust will have wireless capability, computing capability, and sensory capability.
sprinkled about. And no, I don't think Microsoft will ever live on a dust product, but the operating system might only have 1,000 bytes, and the sensor might be a single-purpose sensor, and the wireless system might be simple enough to get a couple meters.
There's actually a company called Crossbow Technologies, and someone may know more about this than I do, but they've licensed a tiny OS operating system, I guess, that came out of, I think it's Berkeley, which is a very efficient, very, for that exact purpose. They're talking about little tiny wireless remotes for a whole variety of functions, and they've licensed this OS specifically to work in a very low-cost, low-function type of environment enabled by wireless connection.
So we haven't heard from Arun yet, and I want to hear, first of all, your answer to the OS question, and then I want to ask you some more things.
Okay. So from our perspective, the OS for us is what the designers do for the network. Right? So we're further back in the whole food chain. And from that perspective, we see a lot of Unix and Linux. Linux is starting to take on a lot of the prevalence in terms of mindshare.
Wait, you guys deliver soft core processors you can put on anything. Does that come with some OS already, or do you?
So you're right. So we got Neos as our soft processor, and that has a RTOS that you can work through, and it works on any one of the VxWorks or any of the other environments that are available out there.
Very diplomatic of you to name VxWorks first.
Yes.
So. Actually, you know, FPGAs haven't had a good reputation for power use and efficiency. And so what are you doing as head of the wireless division? I mean, tell me how that works and give me some examples of the kinds of products and why people would want to put an FPGA in a wireless unit.
So if you look at wireless networks, okay, so the power requirements for a wireless network is much different than what you have in a headset. Okay, so if you look at a base station, you have PAs that are running at 60 watts, and those are the macro base stations. And then if you start peeling the onion a little bit and say, okay, for each of the functions that I showed earlier, what is the power budget? You're looking at 3 to 4 watts power budget. And so from that perspective, FPGAs play a very good role because what they can do is through their huge parallelism, they can take a lot of the DSP functionality where you'd have to have a farm of a lot of number of devices and bring it down into just one or two devices, bringing down the overall power budget as a whole. Okay, so FPGAs on its own, if you power up, it's kind of saying, okay, what's the comparison point? But if you allow it to do a certain task and say, can you do that certain task within a fixed budget and within a fixed price point, they can definitely do it and more.
I've actually designed a number of these systems with your chips, and I think you missed the most important point, time to market, because the FPGAs allow you to conceive and develop it and not wait for a silicon turn. The time and cost of making a mask are amazing, and if you can take 3 months out of a development budget, then if you ever build 100,000 of them, it's not an FPGA anymore. Then you take it to some sort of semi-custom or some next step. But it doesn't matter if it costs $50 or $100 a unit for that first one. It's all about getting the marketplace.
So you're hitting upon something that's traditionally been the FPGA's role, right? Time to market, and you're right, absolutely, time to market is key, and we allow for that. But again, you're pointing to a point where you think there is a better price analysis that will say that it's going out of 5,000 units, you got to move into a different technology. And so the point I was trying to make earlier was, for example, the Tropos network, the Motorola canopy. Okay? If you take a look at that canopy box, it's selling hundreds of thousands of units, and it just has FPGA inside it. And you're absolutely right. It's all about time to market, but it's also about how quickly can you change the code to address changing requirements. And that's the biggest issue that a lot of OEMs face. As you go out and create a base station for an operator, singular requirements are different than, at that point, AT&T. Now, of course, it's the same. But Singular is different from Vodafone. And so you need to have a system that's capable of being changed pretty quickly. And so, time to market comes back in, but there's a lot of cost advantages inherent there, too.
We can take questions from the floor any time here. I'm not even sure who's... Is this your panel? Or?
All you.
I
colleague Slaitman. I saw both of you had slides mentioning IPv6. When I think of trillions of devices needing to address them, it seems IPv6 is useful. How else do you see it as being useful?
When you talk about trillions of devices, often there will be some sort of gateway between those devices and getting them on the Internet. And there's not always IP between the device and the first hop. And so I think you're going to see many types of devices that don't actually get themselves onto the hard Internet. They have to go through some sort of translation or conversion process before they hit even IPv6, IPv4, or V6.
So a lot of the IPv6, V4 type of things happen in the network side also. And what typically happens there is you need to have some level of lookup table capability that does a translation from one side to the other. And so the current systems that are being designed have that capability built in. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, the FPGA sites coming in and allowing for the conversion.
John Dillon, I'm not sure I get an answer to your question. You asked a question about operating systems. I think what I heard was for devices where the operating system is truly not visual, you don't have any visibility to it, eye contact point of view, there's going to be a hodgepodge of solutions. I don't think I got the answer to the other side, which is if you have to see something, is it the same? Is that a market you think that Microsoft, for example, might dominate? Or do you think people are going to create these little customized interfaces that are going to be spot interfaces that everybody has to learn and contend with over time?
Well, I think it's swing at that. There's user interfaces on cell phones and there's user interfaces on set-top boxes. Set-top boxes, satellite, and cable. Microsoft has tried to play a larger role in that business, and there's been financial and business reasons that the people that owned that business didn't want that to happen. I think some of the same thing has happened in the phone business. There are people in the phone business that would like to limit Microsoft's role in the handset, and I don't think they're completely in control of their own destiny there. So, I think you will see many different flavors of user interfaces on Nokia, Samsung, and the rest of the phones, some of which are homegrown, some of which are licensed from third parties. There are other third parties in the business that actually can give you an entire user interface for your cell phone that has no Microsoft content and has no other licensing barriers to it. And then there's Java and Brew, which are running on top of these things, which do provide some consistency.
Well, Marco, this is off the topic, sorry. I heard some statistic somewhere, and I've forgotten what the number is, and you might know it, but some incredible percentage of the no-user interface operating systems are written for each application. It's like, you know what that number is? Like,
yeah, it's roughly
50%
of embedded systems. The guy that created the product designed the hardware, wrote the software, also wrote the operating system. They tend to be small, and they tend to be purpose-built. And then they tend to go through a process over time. The marketing guy adds a widget, and then they've got to add another widget, and over time they become spaghetti code. And many of those, at some point, get replaced by a traditional off-the-shelf OS, such as VxWorks, and there are three or four other substantial competitors in that business. But even today, 50% of both unit shipped and byproducts are roughly homegrown operating systems, and it's been that way for 20 years.
I think here again we're selling Chris Anderson's book, The Long Tail. You know, here you've got very specific, niche, purpose-driven types of products being put out there. It's not all dominated by the business.
Well, there's at least one company out there, Zeedman Technology, that's trying to write a program that will write an operating system for you for those applications. According to this thing, we're out of time. Is that right, Aaron? Okay, so we'll quit, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is a reminder to please join us in Cascade Restaurant, one level down from the main lobby, for cocktails and dinner. And we'll be returning back here this evening at 7 p.m. Thank you. So good night.